We're going to bring on our guest for today. This is somebody who I am thankful to call a close personal friend. So joining us via Skype is Mandisa Thomas. She is the founder and president of Black Nonbelievers based in Atlanta. Mandisa, welcome to the show. It's really good to see you. We hope you and your family are staying safe. Thanks for coming on.
Hi, Andrew. Hi, Rebecca. Thank you very much for having me on the show today. It is a pleasure to see you both again.
So before we jump into some of the really uncomfortable issues we're going to discuss, can you tell us a little bit about your organization, Black Nonbelievers, which you founded, and what people can do to support its critical work?
Absolutely. So Black Nonbelievers as an organization was founded in Atlanta in 2011, and our mission is to advocate for, support, and build community for Blacks who are atheists, who are questioning religion in favor of leaving, and who are looking for support and community. And we also provide representation in a number of ways, especially in the form of community building, as well as outreach. We advocate for the open identification of atheists, humanists, and other secular labels. And the best way to support our work is to donate. We are a 501c3 organization. Donations to us are tax deductible. You can find that information on our website.
And people can also support your work at Patreon, which the link to that is below.
Yes, I do have a personal Patreon where I blog about community building, as well as some other personal aspects of my life and other personal perspectives that are relevant to my work and my life.
Great. And we would really encourage everybody watching to go support Black Nonbelievers, a fantastic organization doing really important work.
So the stories that are dominating the news this week are obviously the coronavirus and George Floyd's killing. I want to talk first about COVID-19 because evidence is showing that it is impacting people of color at higher rates than whites. We have a clip from a news story about this. It highlights Tiffany Green, who's also a friend to FFRF and a secular humanist chaplain. And she's also an assistant professor at UW School of Medicine. So let's take a look.
New numbers tonight show COVID-19 continues to have heavier impacts on communities of color. As of this week, data in Wisconsin shows 26% of patients who died from the virus were African American, despite making up less than 7% of the state's population. UW experts say these numbers are not surprising, but reflective of health inequalities Black Wisconsinites face daily.
The same things that cause those health disparities, disparities in resources, disparities in health care, disparities in income, disparities in wealth, all of those things contribute to disparities in COVID-19.
Now, Green says as government agencies provide relief during the pandemic, it is critical to also provide financial and health care related resources to Black communities in the state.
Now, Mandisa, you know, Dr. Green is telling us there, it sounds like to me, that racial disparities, that inequality is killing Black Americans in more ways than we've seen just related to this protest.
Absolutely. And this is something that we have been informing the general public, especially the secular community, for a number of years, is that issues in the Black community do affect Black atheists as well as the general public, as well as everyone. And that it shows in the inequality, inequity, and imbalance of, you know, the economics and how Black folks are affected, especially in the healthcare system. And we're seeing that especially with this current pandemic.
Yeah, it was truly a shocking report that you sent along.
Yeah. Of course, our other big story is the brutal murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and the nationwide protests, including here in Madison and in Atlanta, where you are. Mandisa, can you tell us a little bit about what's happening in Atlanta?
Yes. So Atlanta, along with other cities across now the world, it was the United States, but now this movement has gone global. There have been protests that have focused on systemic racism and injustice. And at the head of the protests is the Black Lives Matter movement, which was started in 2013 by three Black women. And it's another form of resistance movement. Now, we've seen resistance movements throughout the years. The Civil Rights Movement was also a resistance movement. And this year, there have been three significant murders that have taken place. The first was Ahmaud Arbery down in Brunswick, Georgia, where a former police officer and his son basically tracked him down and shot him. And he was doing nothing more than jogging in the neighborhood. The second is Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky, who was shot and killed by police serving a no-knock warrant and on the wrong residence. And the final was George Floyd, who was arrested by police. He was in the process of being detained and handcuffed. And there was a white officer who kneeled on his neck for about 8 minutes, causing his death. And it was videotaped. And so these are just three significant tragedies in a long line of deaths of Black people at the hands of law enforcement. And it's now taking a international stage because for years there have been protests, there has been resistance, but it has been met with little accountability for law enforcement, which of course has sparked outrage, and it's very understandable. And but now it's getting to the point where enough is enough. There should be no lives, especially no Black lives, that are taken at the hands of police officers. So now Atlanta and other cities across the world are taking a stand against the brutality.
And Mandisa, when we were preparing for this show, you mentioned that we wanted to talk about Breonna Taylor and specifically about how female victims of police killings, particularly Black women, are often overlooked. And that was such a great point and something that I feel that I also overlook. And so let's talk about that a little bit more. Can you talk about her story some more and other Black women who've really been ignored during this?
Yes. So let me just say that you know, there has always been a spotlight on Black men who were murdered that goes back to the days of when lynching was legal and also celebrated in this country. And that was often due to a number of either false or minor claims, or criminal claims. And there were a lot of Black men who were and a lot of Black men who still are being murdered as a result of at white hands and also at the result of law enforcement. However, Black women have always taken a lead role in resistance movements, and we've always bore the brunt of the work. And unfortunately, because the way women are treated in society in general, Black women tend to be often the most dispensable and often more overlooked because of male dominance. Now, again, we don't take away from what has happened to, you know, Black men, because that is absolutely important. But as we see that women are involved in these movements and they're also being murdered, unfortunately, they don't get as much support or visibility. And another example of that would be Corinne Gaines, who was murdered a few years ago. Renisha McBride, who was murdered in Michigan, right outside of Detroit a few years ago in a predominantly white neighborhood. And so, unfortunately, their legacies and their tragic deaths are often drowned out by the number of coverage of Black men who are killed. And I think that's also a result of, you know, systemic racism and patriarchy that people may not necessarily realize that they're doing.
Right. And that Breonna Taylor's story was heartbreaking. They were sleeping and it was the wrong house. And they were trying to defend themselves. It was horrible. Yes. So what can we as atheists, agnostics, and freethinkers, these secular organizations that we support, what can we do to support this movement and this resistance?
And that's a question too. That question's been coming in. That's probably, we've gotten it four or five different ways already. I think this is the thing that are on most of our viewers' mind. And let's add too, not just freethinkers, but what can secular organizations do as well?
Yes. So there are a number of secular organizations who have already released statements. The American Humanist Association, of which I serve on the board, has denounced, the police brutality as well as the recent murders. They've also previously published in their magazine about, do Black Lives Matter to Humanists? There has been more of a focus on having this discussion. There are a number of humanists that could definitely take the time to educate themselves and inform, have conversations with their children about these issues and how important they are, and how they hit more close to home than people realize. The time for being unaware or being willfully unaware of the issues that the Black community faces is over. And also, most important though, you can financially support, donate to Black organizations, especially that amplify Black voices, as well as the work that Black activists are doing in their communities that focus on harm reduction, police brutality, and also community building. There are a number of economic justice, environmental justice outlets, because these all intersect. And our organization in particular very much is an outlet for uplifting those voices in the work that Black activists are doing, and those who are atheists, by the way. And because their voices matter and their work matters. And it doesn't have to be that you are at the center as a white person. Try to decenter your personal feelings about it, because this is a human rights issue. It's a global issue, again, that affects all of us. And we do, you do have the opportunity to support the work that Black organizations are doing.
Yeah, that was a great answer. And you mentioned a couple times in there, and we mentioned at the beginning before, well, we were talking about this before, about having uncomfortable conversations, and that, that's kind of the least some of us can do right now. And, Rebecca and I have young white kids, and, what can we do to help them? You mentioned having conversations with your kids. What can we do to help them become allies for racial justice? The uncomfortable conversation I have to have with my kids, nothing compared to the conversation that you're going to have with your kid. What is it that we can be telling them?
You could start by telling them the kind of conversations that Black parents will have to have with their Black children. The fact that if it is possible that if they are approached by law enforcement, that they can lose their life. It is more likely that as someone who is Black, that this is a possibility, that a encounter with law enforcement could possibly mean their death. And I don't think it is, important for white children to understand what that could be like. And also how, if they choose one day, and this is for Black children as well, if they choose to go into law enforcement, how they can do things differently, how they can empathize with families, with Black families, and especially if there are Black children who are dealing, if they are in working class or poorer neighborhoods, what they deal with, and learning to understand and realizing that the world is, is a big place. It can be very ugly, and it's important for them to understand this before they step out into the real world as adults.
And there are definitely a lot of resources that seem to be coming out now, too. I saw this morning that CNN is going to be doing a town hall with Sesame Street talking about racism. I don't know if you've ever watched some of those programs or if you would recommend things like that, or if there are books that we can share with our children as well. I know a lot of lists have been circulating on social media. Have you seen those? Do you recommend watching those with kids or reading those with kids as well?
Absolutely. My upbringing was very, very activist in nature. It was very woke in nature. So I grew up learning about the Black Panthers. I grew up learning about Malcolm X and how children were also involved in the civil rights movement. And I think that there are a number of I can't recall any offhand, but there are a number of anti-racist resources now that that are available for everyone, especially in the children's book form. But I do recommend, at least for adults, reading The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. That's definitely a
amazing
start.
Book.
Yes. And so, but yes, there are a number of resources that, you know, that are Googleable. That is a word for all children and all adults as well, to be informed and educated about what Black communities go through and what people go through in marginalized communities, and being more aware and also be willing to help.
And you said anti-racist there too, and I think that's probably a term that maybe a lot of people are not quite familiar with. Can you elaborate on that a little bit for our viewers?
Yes. Yeah, so, racism and racist tends to be a very, very ugly and uncomfortable word, as well as a very uncomfortable topic, because there are a lot of people, especially white people, who would like to think themselves as not being racist. But as Jeremiah Kamara, who also spoke at last year's Freedom from Religion Foundation convention, he showed his documentary, Holy Hierarchy, The Religious Roots of Racism in America. And it specifically detailed how in American law racism was instituted. And so now people think that because there are no actual laws on the books that prohibit Black folks from eating at certain places or going certain places, the institution itself has had a mental effect on people for centuries, which means that it also comes across in how people either ignore the plight of Black folks and also what they may think of the Black community subconsciously or overtly. And so there's a number of ways to deconstruct how one may be racist without even realizing that they are. And so being anti-racist means that we now need to start looking at the systemic actions as well as individual actions in order to turn this around.
So I've been doing homework on this, too. And I wanted to read a passage to you this is what I've been reading lately, How to Be an Anti-Racist by Dr. Kendi. And he talks about this a lot in here. And I wanted to get your take on this, because we've been talking about, these are uncomfortable conversations for people to have, but that's literally the least we can do. So he writes that racist and anti-racist are like peelable name tags that are placed and replaced based on what someone is doing or not doing, supporting or expressing in each moment. These are not permanent tattoos. No one becomes a racist or anti-racist. We can only strive to be one or the other. We can knowingly strive to be a racist. We can unknowingly strive to be a racist, excuse me. We can knowingly strive to be anti-racist. Like fighting an addiction, being an anti-racist requires persistent self-awareness, constant self-criticism, and regular self-examination. And, that really shifted something in my mind, trying to deal personally with these issues in terms of my own mental framework. I wonder if you can talk about that, too. And do you see that as valid? Do you think that's an easier way for people to begin discussing this?
Absolutely, because I would love for more white people to put themselves in the shoes of Black folks, because we've had to be mindful of what we say and what we do for years, you know, in order to be either considered accepted or to get to a certain place in our society. And the privilege has been for white folks not to have to think about that, not to have to think about what they say or what they do, which could ultimately mean their lives or their livelihood. And so, yes, to work on that systemic piece means watching, thinking about what you say, also how you treat people, because I have come across this from a number of folks, and it doesn't mean that it's it doesn't mean that it's systemic. It could be something, you know, as small as how you are treating, you know, the difference in how you treat someone white and someone Black or another person of color. And yes, it can be uncomfortable to constantly think about what you say and what, because self-reflection and introspection can be very difficult for people. I think internal change is one of the hardest things that people may have to deal with, especially those who have been used to doing things for a certain for a long period of time, and they realize that now they can't do it anymore. And that it isn't impossible to do, but it's something that, especially for white folks, especially the ones who say they care about Black communities, if they care about, you know, systemic racism and injustice, and they consider themselves progressive. These are actually the ones who need to be minding what they do the most, because as we saw in the instance of Amy Cooper in New York, the white woman who called the police on the Black guy, Christian Cooper, she was supposedly this bleeding heart liberal, but yet in her language, it was extremely racist. So we can look to that as an example of what we see a number of people do, even if they don't think they are racist.
We've got one question real quick. A couple of people are interested in the documentary, Jeremiah's documentary. Can you give them that name again?
Sure. It's called Holy Hierarchy, The Religious Roots of Racism in America, and it's available on Amazon Prime. I highly recommend watching that, in addition to his first documentary, Contradiction. And I'm not just promoting that simply because I'm in it, but that's another story. But yes, Jeremiah's, both of his documentaries are really, really good. But yes, if you want to learn more about or get a better understanding of how racism was instituted in this country, I definitely recommend watching it.
You know, I did an Atheist at the Movies watch party on Twitter, and we watched God's Not Dead, which was awful. So maybe our next movie will be Jeremiah's instead, which sounds like actually useful to watch and educational, as opposed to leaning into stereotypes. So we were getting a lot of questions rolling in. Kelly asked, Amandisa, can you speak a little bit more about implicit bias?
Someone asked that question?
Yes, Kelly asked that on Facebook.
So implicit bias, and I think we all have biases, you know, I think that's a part of our nature as human beings. But when we talk about, you know, people who might be unaware of what those biases are, and it may be based on your upbringing, it may be based on your perception of what, you know, of what you of other people and other people that you may not have engaged with before. It could come from certain experiences, whether they be traumatic, and it could be, and also how you've been educated, because that's also another point, that just because someone is educated doesn't necessarily mean they're informed. And so therefore, our experiences, our lived experiences, may tend to inform what these biases are. And it's important, though, to realize and understand how we may have been indoctrinated in a number of ways so that we can try to recognize what they are.
So we got a fun comment from Will J down in Texas. Hey, buddy. He said, supporting Mandisa Thomas is supporting a badass and wonderful human being in the free thought community. She's terrific. Yes, Will's right. Everybody do it. We're getting just a ton of questions here. So I'm trying to filter them and trying to, you know, put them through the in with the questions that Rebecca and I kind of prepared for this. Lisa asked one that related to something we were talking about a little bit earlier. She said that my daughter is in junior high school, and for the first time, I'm having these conversations with her. Why do you think so many students in American schools have never been taught about these issues? Do you think if we created lessons in public school curriculums, it could help the movement?
Yes, it does depend on where you are in the country. I was born, I'm from New York, and I'm a product of the public school system. So there were quite a few lessons that were taught about, you know, Black history, systemic injustice and racism. And I was fortunate enough to have teachers who were, you know, who emphasized that, who advocated for Black children to know that. There are other teachers in school systems who aren't that forward thinking, especially if you are in a smaller town and your schools are terribly underfunded, which is the case for a number of county and school systems across this country. It's interesting how we're primed to think that other countries and their, or what is considered third world, have insufficient education systems, and within the United States, that is so very true. Also, some of the people on these boards in these school systems are very religious in nature, and they may try to block that education. So it's also important that even if you are not getting that within your school system, do try to find resources online and in your local libraries. My mother was not completely dependent on the public school system to educate me and my brothers. So yeah. We went to the library and we read. I was an avid reader as a kid. We went to a lot of cultural programs that were often free in New York. So if you can find those resources in your area, it is possible. You can definitely utilize them to show and to talk with your children about them. And I think it is important to start talking about it now.
Excellent. So I want to ask another uncomfortable question. You know, secularism as a movement is largely white. And I think that's an uncomfortable point for many people in the movement. And you know, we've seen these protesters at these rallies holding signs that they say, stop killing us. So I think the question that I'm trying to fumble for here is, you know, if survival absorbs your political activism and your bandwidth, you know, is fighting for a secular government in a way itself a privilege?
It actually makes it more important to fight for a secular government. However, the means to do it does differentiate and it does vary, because many supporters of the secular movement, which is completely understandable and completely valid, tends to overlook that secular government or the government has been overtly racist and discriminatory towards the black community and other marginalized communities. So it is more important now than ever that secular organizations understand how these fights and how these protests actually align with the work that they're doing. And it shouldn't just be that, while you shouldn't try to co-opt the Black voices that are doing this work, it's important to support it in conjunction with, because I guarantee you that, yes, if human lives are important to you as a secularist or humanist, then Black lives are important as well. And historically, the secular community, yes, because there has been a focus on education and intellect and or those who seem to perpetuate intellectualism, because there are certainly a number of Black activists and scholars who were very intelligent and intellectual. Unfortunately, those legacies tend to be overlooked by the majority of secular organizations. And I don't have a problem discussing that, because it is definitely it is time for us to have that. It's way past the time for us to have that conversation as to who is presenting this information and why this labor always tends to fall on Black leaders and activists and organizations with very little support. That's often a, you know, that's a point that needs to be made, because it's not that the information isn't out there. It's who is willing to do that work and who is willing to support others doing the work.
And on that note, I was just told that we're interviewing Jeremiah Kamara tomorrow on Free Thought Radio to talk about his documentaries again. So
nice.
People may want to tune into that. Rebecca, there's a question sitting on your G-chat. And then we also have a question, and this is something that I hear all the time, and it's frustrating and it's trollish, but I'm going to ask it because I think it's important for people to have a response to this silly argument, Mandisa. It came in via email, and the person writes, "I was talking to my dad and telling him how I supported Black Lives Matter protests. He responded that all lives matter as a gotcha." How do you respond to the all lives matter people who are really trying to belittle the importance of the Black Lives Matter movement?
It's interesting how all lives matter when, you know, if for trivial things, you know, it's like, yeah, it's supposed to be a given that all lives mm-hmm. matter. But when it comes to people, other like marginalized groups, people of color, trans men and women, all of a sudden their lives don't seem to matter to, you know, to certain, i.e. white people. And as there are a disproportionate number of Black folks who lose their lives as a result of, you know, these systemic issues and actions and law enforcement, it's as if our lives are expendable. And so we need for our we need to show that, yes, our lives do matter, because Black folks all over the world do seem to be expendable and overlooked in favor of others. And so, yes, as you can, as people don't have to think about whether they have to deal with this up front. And because I came from a neighborhood where I had to see this up front and close and personal. And so there are others who may not have had to. And so, you know, having that, you know, that perspective, and it's like, we're not going to force you to, you know, to try to understand what we're going through and what we're fighting for. But just know that that is a bias to say that all lives matter, because that means that you're becoming defensive to communities and people who have, you know, who have been subjugated for far too long.
Yeah, that was a great answer. And there have been some good answers too floating around online. I saw a web comic actually that just like really hit home as two houses, one on fire, one not. And you know, this similar conversation, one guy saying all houses matter. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we have a question from our own co-president, Dan Barker. He says, "Hi, Mandisa. Did you see the Bible Trump was holding as more than a simple Christian nationalism? Do you see it as an instrument of oppression, especially since it endorses slavery?"
Well, yes, as it is definitely a symbol of oppression, as especially as this very sociopathic white man is holding it. And this has been the weapon that many people have used to oppress and murder many. And the people tend to forget that the Ku Klux Klan was a Christian organization that also included law enforcement officials and politicians. So for people who don't think that these things are connected, they would be wrong. And so, yes, he is holding up a very, very long-standing symbol of oppression. And actually, for him to be holding it as that same day he ordered tear gas to be, you know, to be used on protesters in D.C. For him to use that is just it's very typical. I can't even say it's hypocritical, but it is typical of Christian nationalism, which does include racism, and oppression.
So one of the questions that I have, and I'll probably also fumble through this as I'm thinking about it, is that these riots and these protests are happening, and they've been happening for a number of days now, and it really feels like that this is a moment that could really transform what's happening in our country and really be a time for us to really change and end things. And I know movements don't always end, they evolve, and there's always work to do. But my question is, how does this end? And I had posed this to my husband last night while we were talking, and I said, how does this end? Because everything seems on fire, and this just seems like the lowest of the low. And he said, well, you know, it was like this during the Rodney King protests and riots, and that went on for about a week, and then everybody just kind of moved on. And that was really disheartening for me to hear, because I feel like that's very similar to the Me Too movement, where like women make this huge splash in the news, and there's all this talk about change and women running for office and things like that, and then it kind of fizzles out, and then 20 years later, here we are again. But I really feel that this moment different. And do you feel that way? And how can we make it different if it's not?
So yes, I'm a history buff. I'll give some background on that. I'm a history buff, and so I've read up and been educated on different resistance movements and riots that have dated back to early centuries in the United States. The civil rights movement certainly was a resistance movement, I would say. And also, especially once Dr. King was murdered, the riots and the unrest that took place after that. And so, yes, we see this resurgence about every 20 years or so. And I think the problem comes in when, as a general public and also our officials, we tend to move on to the next trending topic or the next trending cause. And people don't realize that the work on the back end still needs to be done. So, yes, this is transformative, hopefully in the way that we see that. First of all, this has been going on for way too long. There should be no reasons why this is recycling every 20 years or even every year. So it should begin to change and start to make a turn when we start definitely doing things more foundational, knowing who our representatives are, starting at the local government, revisiting these laws and these procedures and start changing them and start, you know, I know some people may think I sound like a socialist or something, but looking at the economic benefit of, you know, for all and not just some, because as long as you have that imbalance of resources and those who have access to it and those who don't, there's always going to be a problem. There will always be a problem when people have to struggle to pay bills, when people have to struggle to make ends meet for their families. And you have some folks who are trying to tell you how to make it, but they've been, you know, but they've never had to struggle a day in their life. That does make a difference. And I think as we continue to examine and try and definitely try to revise and change these foundations, then hopefully we won't see these resurgences every few years.
Rebecca, why don't you ask about the conference, and then we'll close it up. We're getting on an hour.
Oh, yes. So last year, you guys had your inaugural Women of Color Beyond Belief conference in Chicago. I'm wearing the shirt, although people can't really see it right now via Skype. But FFRF was a sponsor, and we sent staff down to Chicago to be with you for that weekend. It was an amazing experience. The takeaway that I had from it was just how wonderfully diverse of a group it was and how much I learned. And obviously, you guys were planning on doing it again in 2020. And now with COVID, I was just wondering, what are the plans for that conference?
So we're looking at hopefully still being able to convene in person, of course, with all of the safety measures in place. We are, though, watching the summer season as I know health experts are predicting a second wave. And unfortunately, with the current circumstances, we're hoping that people are remaining safe even as they protest out in public so that this doesn't happen. We are hoping to, because we have another lineup of wonderful speakers, and the focus this year is going to be on how people who get involved in the movement actually try to take care of themselves and also next steps. You know, how do people, you know, partake in the political process? You know, how do they engage on the local levels, which leads up to the national level? And so that hopefully we will see a good change for this next election cycle. That's all I'm going to say about that. And I really do appreciate FFRF's generous support last year, and we hope to be able to count on it again this year. We will keep everyone updated, hopefully, by the. But if push comes to shove and we can't host it in person, then we will have some sessions virtually, and we'll keep you updated on that.
Great.
And also shout out to Sakivu Hutchinson and Bria Crutchfield, who are my sisters in arms with the conference.
Well, Mandisa, thank you so much for joining us today to have an important, educational, and uncomfortable conversation. It's just the beginning. I don't even think we can say we scratched the surface. There's so much here. We all have homework. We all have a lot of work to do. Thank you for at least pointing us in the right direction.
Thank you once again for having me. It's been great. I really respect and love the work that FFRF does, and the fact that they are, you know, y'all are very inclusive of the, you know, the perspectives of Black folks and people of color. And that makes a huge difference.
Thank you for those kind words. And we're going to talk a little bit about this again next week with our guest, who's a sociologist, Phil Zuckerman. He was tweeting out some data about how African-Americans and secular Americans seem to have the strongest understanding of systemic racism. We're going to talk to him about that and the responses to COVID across religious countries and religious states versus non-religious countries and non-religious states. So that's our show for this week. Thank you so much for joining us on Ask an Atheist. If you want more information about FFRF, check out our website. And please be sure to support Black non-believers and the work that Mandisa is doing. It really is absolutely critical